Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Alice Bryant and Anna Mateo. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, as Americans celebrate their national holiday this week, the debate about who belongs in the country continues. Recently, the Supreme Court of the United States ruled that the government can restrict travel by citizens from 5 Muslim-majority countries. And President Donald Trump says he is enforcing a zero-tolerance policy on immigrants crossing the U.S.-Mexico border without documentation. Activists have objected to the policy, especially to border officials separating children from their parents. Reporter Becky Little points out that discussions about immigration have been part of American life for most of the nation's existence. What has changed over time is how the U.S. has dealt with immigrants and what it calls them. Little says the term illegal immigrants is relatively new. She notes that, before the U.S. Constitution was approved, the people who came here were not immigrants. They were settlers seeking to create their own laws and enslaved Africans who came against their will. Little observes that American immigration didn't really begin until the late 1700s, when the United States became an independent nation. For about 80 years, most people who wanted to move to the U.S. faced few official restrictions. But Little points out that does not mean they were always welcome. Some Americans objected to Irish and Italian immigrants because they were Roman Catholic. They also blamed Chinese workers for low wages and the country's economic problems. In answer, the federal government set the first legal restrictions on immigration. The Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882 banned most Chinese people from settling permanently in the U.S. For Americans, this ban led to the idea that the Chinese-born people they met could be in the country illegally. In the following years, lawmakers approved policies barring people from other parts of Asia. They also limited the number of overall immigrants, especially those coming from Southern and Eastern Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. But there were few restrictions on people from Mexico who immigrated to or worked in the United States. That changed in 1965 when U.S. lawmakers passed a major immigration reform. The law made moving to the U.S. easier for some groups, but more difficult for people from Mexico. Even with the restrictions, the number of people entering the country from Mexico did not drop sharply. In the 1950s and 1960s, some Americans freely called Mexicans wetbacks. The term was meant to suggest that a person seeking work in the U.S. had crossed through the Rio Grande River instead of entering the country officially. The Washington Post notes that by the 1970s, the term wetback was widely considered to be insulting. Activists suggested the media and government use terms like illegal aliens or illegal entrants. Many officials accepted their advice. Even the Supreme Court began using the adjective illegal to describe people from any country who entered the U.S. without official approval. But in the 1990s, the term illegal alien began losing some of its popularity. Some media organizations dropped it from their style books. They argued that actions can be illegal, but not people themselves. In 2009, one of the High Court's justices, Sonia Sotomayor, officially used the term undocumented immigrant instead. She said the word illegal can make people think that immigrants are all criminals, like robbers and murderers. In fact, a 2012 Supreme Court decision found that being in the U.S. without authorization is not a crime. It is a civil offense. However, the act of crossing into the U.S. incorrectly is a more serious violation called a misdemeanor. But it is not as serious as a felony, an act of violent crime.
The Associated Press, or AP, reports that arrests at the border between Mexico and the United States fell sharply in the month of June. The AP report says its information came from a U.S. official. The lower number follows 4 months of increases. The number could be a product of President Donald Trump's policy of bringing criminal charges against every adult who enters the country illegally. Or it could be the result of changing seasons. U.S. border agents made more than 34,000 arrests along the Mexican border during June, down 16% compared to the number in May. The June numbers were being described as preliminary and may change. The AP report said the sharp drop could undermine the Trump administration's storyline of a crisis at the border. Customs and Border Protection, which includes the Border Patrol, refused to comment on the numbers. The agency said it does not discuss them as a matter of policy until they are officially released to the public. The administration announced in May that it was taking legal action against every illegal entry, including adults who came with their children. More than 2,000 boys and girls have been separated from their parents since they crossed the border without documentation. On June 20th, the president amended the policy, ordering that detained families should stay together. Kevin McLeanan is head of U.S. Customs and Border Protection. He told reporters last week that the number of border arrests were trending lower. McLeanan said he would not provide the numbers until their public release in early July. The AP story was published 2 days after thousands of people demonstrated in cities, big and small, across the country. They were protesting the administration's policy of prosecuting every migrant who crosses the border illegally. In New York City, thousands of protesters marched across the Brooklyn Bridge to show their opposition to the policy. There were similar protests in Los Angeles, Boston, and Chicago. I'm Alice Bryant.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. One of the most common complaints among American parents today Is children spending too much time on a computer or other electronic devices? This is especially true if the child spends several hours a day playing video games. Parents may begin to worry that gaming is more than just a waste of time. They fear it might become an addiction. The child could develop a strong desire or need to keep playing. Officials at the World Health Organization are worried too. They say playing video games creates strong feelings of pleasure and reward in the brain. And in some cases, that can lead to addictive behavior. So the WHO has listed gaming disorder as a mental health condition. Mental health experts are debating whether the move is helpful or not. They say the WHO's declaration may simply frighten parents into thinking their child is addicted to video games. But to others, the possibility of gaming becoming an addiction is very real. After all, video game creators want to design programs that keep people playing. People can slowly become addicted to video gaming. Some may play for hours. They lose interest in doing other things. They stop going to school or work. Canadian Cam Adair was one of them.
Originally, when I started gaming, it was fine. You know, I was a healthy kid, happy kid, played hockey, but eventually it began to become a problem. And I actually ended up dropping out of high school, not once, but twice, never graduated, never went to college, and got to a point where I was pretending to have jobs, playing video games up to 16 hours a day.
Some addiction experts say signs of gaming addiction are similar to alcoholism and drug addiction. Christopher Mulligan is director of the Cyber Addiction Recovery Center in Los Angeles. He also treats patients for all kinds of technology addiction, from gaming to text messaging. He says that video game addicts experience the same highs and lows as drug addicts do. The high is from dopamine. Dopamine is a chemical in the brain. It is responsible for sending signals between nerve cells, or neurons. As Mulligan notes, one of the lows is when the gamer stops playing.
Gamers, texters, kids that are doing reading and watching YouTube videos get this dopamine release. When it stops abruptly, they really experience almost spontaneous withdrawals.
But not everyone who plays video games is addicted. Based on reports, the WHO estimates that only a very small percentage of video game players are addicts, about 3% in all. It adds that most of them are from East and South Asia. But that does not mean we can't watch for warning signs. The WHO's Shekar Saxena says there are some signs that may mean a person has or is developing a gaming addiction.
Be careful if the person you are with is using gaming in an excessive manner. If it is consuming too much time and if it's interfering with the expected functions of the person, whether it's studies, whether it's socialization, whether it's work, then you need to be cautious and perhaps seek help.
Some experts reject the idea of listing extreme video gaming as an addiction. They argue that extreme gaming is a sign of other problems. These experts say that some people use video games to help with nervousness or depression. They add that children are more likely to get addicted to video games if they lack social skills. When children are better socially, they say, their need for gaming will decline. Cam Adair, the former video game addict, welcomed the WHO's decision. He said it will lead to greater recognition of the problem so that people can get treatment. Christopher Mulligan notes that addiction to video games cannot be treated in the same way as alcoholism or drug abuse. A person can avoid drugs and alcohol, but that is not the case with modern technology. The goal, he adds, is to create a relationship with technology that can last throughout the person's life.
They're going to have to get back online eventually. They're going to have to use their computers. They're going to have to use their phones. So it's really teaching this very challenging goal of sustainable relationship to technology.
The World Health Organization says identifying gaming disorder as a disease will help its members recognize the problem and prepare ways to treat it. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. By the middle of the 1930s, America seemed to be moving out of the worst depression in its history. Most people supported the New Deal policies of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The dark view that many Americans held during the final days of President Herbert Hoover's administration seemed to be changing. People began to believe that the United States was facing its problems with energy and hope. Harry Monroe and Jack Weitzel tell more about the New Deal programs of President Roosevelt.
The change could be seen in the way that Americans were moving away from extreme political movements of both the right and the left. Many decided that the best solution was to work through the existing political system. Most importantly, Roosevelt's continued experiments with different programs showed Americans that they did not have to blindly follow political or economic traditions. For years, most Americans had accepted the basic ideas of traditional free market capitalism. But as the Depression began, a small number of Americans became interested in the economic ideas of Karl Marx. Roosevelt believed it was best to travel a path between these two opposite ideas. He basically supported the free market system, but he believed government also had a right and responsibility to act when needed, and he supported new government controls in such important areas as banking, transportation, agriculture, and oil production.
Some Americans did not think it was wise or even possible to mix traditional free market capitalism with government intervention or socialism. Former Republican Treasury Secretary Ogden Mills put it this way: "We can have a free country or a socialist one. We cannot have both. Our economic system cannot be half free and half socialistic. There is no middle ground between governing and being governed, between absolute rule and freedom." Many leftists and socialists agreed with conservatives that it was impossible to mix capitalism and socialism. One leftist publication wrote, "Either the nation must live with the sadness of capitalism, or it must prepare to replace capitalism with socialism. There is no longer a practical middle path. However, Roosevelt and his New Dealers happily rejected these arguments. They aimed the country between rightist and leftist extremes and created a whole new set of rules for government, the economy, and democracy.
Most Americans supported Roosevelt and the Democrats as they experimented with new solutions to the problems of the Depression. They elected Democrats to a large majority in Congress in 1934. 2 years later, they re-elected Franklin Roosevelt to a second term in the White House by one of the largest victories in American history. Roosevelt's big victory made him stronger than ever, so he decided to fight the part of the government that had been blocking many of his programs, the Supreme Court.
Most of the 9 judges on the Supreme Court in 1936 were conservative. They had ruled that many of Roosevelt's most important New Deal programs were illegal. Now, the judges were preparing to decide the future of programs to help old people, labor unions, and others. And there was nothing the president could do under the American system of government. So, Roosevelt called for changes in the system. He asked Congress to reorganize the federal judicial system, and he asked for the power to add several new members to the Supreme Court. In this way, Roosevelt hoped to gain a new majority on the court that would support his views.
Most Americans liked Roosevelt, but people of all opinions feared that the president was trying to destroy the careful system of checks and balances in the federal government. They agreed with him in opposing the court's decisions, but they accepted the right of Supreme Court judges to rule as they thought correct. For this reason, the nation rejected Roosevelt's plan to add new members to the court.
Roosevelt's unsuccessful effort to change the Supreme Court came at the same time as the economy began to get worse. Many Americans thought they had defeated the Depression in 1935, and 36. There was steady economic improvement. Some bankers had even begun to fear that the economy was growing too fast. These bankers called on the nation's central bank, the Federal Reserve Board, to control the expanding money supply. And the Federal Reserve acted to limit the amount of money in use. At the same time, the federal government began reducing the amount of money that it was spending, and it launched the new Social Security tax on workers' incomes. The effect of all these government actions was to limit the amount of money being spent by the government, companies, and private citizens. As a result, the economy began to fall once again into depression.
In August 1937, stock market prices began to fall sharply. In 7 months, the price of stock for the General Motors Corporation fell from $60 to $25. The United States Steel Company stock fell all the way from $121 to $38. In fact, the stock markets lost in 9 months about two-thirds of all the gains that they had made so slowly and painfully since Roosevelt took office. Americans had supported Roosevelt's New Deal program because it offered a solution to the Depression. Now that program seemed to be failing.
Historian Frederick Lewis Allen remembered those dark days of 1937. Goods sold slowly, Allen wrote. Businessmen became frightened and reduced production. 2 million men were thrown out of work in the space of a few months. They became less able to buy what was for sale. The terrible circle of the falling value of the dollar moved all the more rapidly.
The new economic crisis hurt Roosevelt's popularity, and it came at a time when he faced growing opposition within his own Democratic Party. For several years, conservative Democrats from the southeastern part of the country had supported Roosevelt. They liked his leadership and the power that he brought to all Democrats. But they opposed many of his more liberal or experimental social policies.
As the economy and Roosevelt's popularity fell, many of these Southern Democrats began to openly oppose his leadership. They voted with Republicans on important bills before Congress. Roosevelt became very angry about the new opposition from within his own party. He began to intervene personally in Democratic Party primary elections in 1938. He told party members in several states that they should only vote for candidates who would support his New Deal policies. Roosevelt's opponents accused him of interfering in local politics, and Democratic voters agreed with these criticisms. In almost all cases, they rejected the candidates supported by the president. A few months later, voters in the general election gave the Republicans major gains in both the House of Representatives and Senate.
In most situations, such a change in support would have signaled the end of a president's power. If people will not follow, a president cannot lead or be elected. But such was not the case for Roosevelt and the United States in the late 1930s. It was true that economic and political troubles were not solved, but another crisis was growing larger every day, making these other problems seem less and less important. The crisis was in foreign policy. Adolf Hitler and his Nazi party in Germany seemed ready to make war on Europe, and Japanese forces appeared to be planning new aggression in the Pacific. Americans could no longer just worry about their problems at home. A dark cloud was forming outside their door.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.